CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 57, with Dr. Annalisa Arosemena, a brilliant surgeon who encourages us to rethink the way we treat glaucoma. Welcome back to the Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest, Dr. Annalisa Arosemena, an incredible surgeon, like truly gifted surgeon, does cataract, does some, you know, a lot of glaucoma. I just finished learning from her at the meeting here. OSHA's telling like it is meeting in Tampa. Annalisa, welcome to the podcast. I have 1,000 questions to ask you.
Well, and I have 1,000 answers, but first I want to thank you. I think it's wonderful to be here in the cataractcoach.com podcast.
Cataractcoach.com.
By the end of today, I'm going to finish the whole...
The cataractcoach.com. I love it. Well, you'll have to give us a good video, too, to feature on Cataract Coach, something hopefully MIGS. And that's kind of what I want to cover. I want to talk to you, I'll briefly ask you a few things about MIGS and then maybe talk about your path in ophthalmology. So what I love about you is you embrace the full spectrum of care. So you'll do all the angle surgeries, all the devices. You'll do suprachoroidal things. You'll do tubes and trabs, everything you've mastered. So if I'm a young doctor and I want to learn all these, where do I start?
So I think you first have to get very comfortable inside the eye. I mean, I wouldn't jump into the deep end right from the start. I think that once you get comfortable doing surgery, it's quite easy to move those skills anywhere else. So I trained at Tulane University, and we had Charity Hospital, which was a great learning experience. And I remember as a first year, we were able to do extra caps. Right. And we would put the stitch for our staff. So there was a rule that every patient that had a cataract surgery needed a stitch. Right. And part of it was because as first years, we were able to do that stitch after the case was done. And that got your hands going. So it was not only safety because you have a resident case, but it was also getting the younger residents to be able to use their hands early on. And that, I think, really shaped. I can do an extra cap. I can do a PKP just because of those skills. And God forbid anything bad happens, you need to be comfortable with those skills to be able to save a situation. So that would be my first thing, get very comfortable doing the basics in the eye, and those skills transfer on to all the other parts.
That's great advice. In fact, the suturing, when I used to teach residents for 22 years, I had my rule of 10, 10, 10. In the lab, under the microscope, can you suture a tomato or a grape? 10 sutures of 10 on nylon in 10 minutes. If you can do 10, 10, 10, you got pretty good hands already.
I totally agree. I just kind of started in a patient's eye. See one, do one, teach one. But I think that getting your good hands is so important. I am blessed that I actually had great teachers. I mean, you've actually seen Dr. Ayala operate.
Amazing.
You know, you couldn't do bad, then you wouldn't be doing surgery.
So if I have a young doctor, let's say finishing residency and didn't get a whole lot of MIGS experience, or I have an older doctor in practice who just never learned how to do MIGS, what's the first step? What's the easy MIGS to learn first? Because some are harder than others. What would you
first
recommend?
First thing is learn how to gonio. Okay. If you cannot gonio in the slit lamp, you will know not what you're seeing. If you're not seeing the angle correctly, you will end up putting whatever device in the wrong spot. So get comfortable seeing the angle in the slit lamp, and then get comfortable with the positioning. After that, most of the MIGS are easy. In my hands, at least, I think iStent is very easy. Kahook or Scion, small goniotomies are quite easy. Streamline is very easy. Once you get to catheterizing the canal, it takes a little more security in yourself because the patient might move. It takes a little longer. You know, you are inside the angle throughout iTrack, GAD, or Omni. So those, I think, would be my second stage as I learn.
So if you're in your clinic, you just start using that gonio prism a whole lot more.
Oh, yes. Because, you know, it's so funny how many times patients have different anatomy. You see them, and then there's some that have this pigmented, you know, San Polesi's hand, which, by the way, I actually got to meet in Argentina.
Oh, San Polesi.
That was quite fabulous. Yeah. I want to get something named the Arosemena something, because I still cannot write San Polesi correctly. That and Krukenberg. I still have issues with that. I let the spell check in the in spell check work it out. So I actually, you know, sometimes they have this thick Sampalesis pigmented line and you may confuse it with TM and you're never going to be able to get a result. Or sometimes you have very, very lightly pigmented TMs that you don't recognize.
Yeah.
So those you can stain with a little Trypan blue as your beginning. I think those are a little bit, I used to stain my sens at the beginning with a marking pen.
Oh, interesting.
Because that actually lets you see it right as it's coming, where the end is, and it gives you that safety at the beginning. So there are many tips that they can start. I mean, I think the key is to start. We have to do mates on these patients.
Right.
This is not given astigmatism in glasses. You know, if you have a patient with glaucoma and you're already going in the eye, you should do the mix and give them a chance, you know?
For sure. I think that's a great idea. So in your clinic, start putting the gonio mirror up on a lot of patients, everyone.
Everyone.
To get experience of know what's the variety that you'll see.
And it's surprising because it has nothing to do with the pigment of the patient. You can have very darkly pigmented patients with very light TMs. So that and doing SLT. I mean, if you're doing SLTs, you're used to seeing the angle. So that's a very good practice. So for surgeons that have been in practice for a while, that have been doing SLT and did ALT way back when, they already have that knowledge. They already have that technique and it's easier to apply it to the mixed world.
So if a surgeon now sitting in the operating room and ready to do a MIGS procedure, let's say a KDB,
okay.
Do the MIGS procedure and they put the gonio prism up, but they don't have a great view. What's usually the problem? Not enough head tilt.
So there's two schools in the MIGS. So number one, there's the before cataract and the after cataract schools. So okay. I'm an after cataract thing, but that's just me. Some of the other surgeons are before cataracts. If you're having a murky anterior chamber, your view is not going to be good. So if you have a pigment, like a patient that you have to stretch the pupil or do any kind of manipulation in the eye, do your MIGS before, because those little debris in the AC will actually make your view not as good.
Sure.
So that's the two schools of before and after. And then there's two schools, the ones that tilt the patient and the ones that tilt the microscope. So I'm a busy surgeon. I don't really have time to be cranking the microscope for every patient. And my usual day would vary. It's like a surprise what's coming. Mm-hmm. I know what the mix of the day is going to be. So I know I'm going to have, you know, 10 cataracts, 12 MIGs, and a couple of the transplant or a tube or a trap going around, but I don't know in what order they're coming.
Sure.
So moving the microscope between cases was a real pain in the behind for me. So I move the head of the patient.
Like a lot then? Because usually I would move the head of the patient somewhat and move my scope to see the angle. You just do it all.
Oh, no. I don't. My scope stays in the same position the entire day. And I will get the patient to really turn. And I actually, if the patient is very cooperative, I will have the patient also look away from me.
Sure.
I tell them look away from me, and that gives me perfect positioning between the head tilt and just the patient looking to the side, which actually helps them, because the patients, when they look to the side, it's for them, it's like they're actually helping in the procedure. They feel, instead of wondering, they have an order of what they need to do. These patients are fully awake,
right?
You know, maybe a little sedation for pain or for discomfort for the cataract surgery, but by turning the head and looking away, you pretty much get it on fast every time. It saves you a little time at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, for sure. Another thing I've learned to do is, normally in a normal phaco, I like to barely hit the limbal vessels when I make my incision.
Oh, yes. And that's a normal
thing. Then you get the blood mixed with under the gonio.
Oh,
prism.
That is terrible. It took me a while to change that, because once you've been doing cataract surgery and you're in your groove, that wound just goes right there. And the more you say, I don't want to do it there, it's like, so I had a friend that was playing golf and he said that if he was in a tournament, he would always say to the other people, like, don't hit that. Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. And they would end up doing it. That was his trick to win.
Like the reverse psychology.
Get it in your head. So it's like, don't hit the limbos. And then you end up hitting it in the paracentesis. Yeah. So I do move my wounds a little bit away from the limbos to avoid those vessels, because it is a visibility killer.
Right.
It really shuts it down.
Blood, if you get blood under the gonioprism, prism, the view is terrible.
And then you try to hold a Wexel to it and it never works. Yeah. You try it and it never works. So if it does happen, my recommendation, I do hold a Wexel on that limbus, put my gonioprism, prism, and then I don't lift it. If you don't move that gonioprism, you stay with it, you will not get it under. The problem is if you're putzing around with the visibility and the view and the tilt, then that blood gets right into that interface. And then you have to start again. That is such a great thing. I you forget to mention that.
Yeah, because it's a little things. Yeah, little things I learned the hard way.
We all learn the hard way. That's how we can teach. I mean, there's a lot of things I know not to do because I ended up thinking I could do it. So I was placing an infinite, you know, that's the three stents.
Yeah, three of them.
Three stents. And this patient already had a nasal goniotomy. So I put two of them that I could fit in that nasal, supranasal angle. And then I was like, I'm going to put it temporal. I took the patient back, and thank God the patient didn't have a big nose. I actually have the video of it. I was able to put the stent temporally.
So you made an nasal incision.
It wasn't easy. It was not easy to do. So you learn the hard way, and that is another thing you want to keep in mind. You know, as you're learning, you want to be less destructive because it gives you another stage where you can treat it in the future.
Right. Sure. So when do you make the decision? Let's say you have a cataract patient, going to have cataract surgery. When do you make the decision of, okay, I should add Migzon, or no, their glaucoma is more advanced, I'm probably going to need to do like a tube or trab. How do you differentiate that?
So I go back to the astigmatism. I will give astigmatism to every prescription I give. If they have it, if they have 0.50 of astigmatism, I will try to treat it.
Sure.
Your quality of vision is better. So even if a patient has severe glaucoma and it's controlled, so I have a 80-year-old patient that has a pressure of 13, but has severe glaucoma and happens to have a cataract. Why not get him off two or three drops?
Right. There's no downside.
There's no downside. Now, there are some MIGs that are not approved for severe glaucoma, so they're only mild to moderate. But if you can take that one medication or those two drops that they have to put a day, it's a huge change in their life. Very few times, I think, I don't know what your saddest patients, all my patients are happy, but I see the dissolution on a patient that is medication-free after a mix, after a couple of years, you know, it's been 2-3 years, and you're like, pressure is going up, I need to start you again. And their face just drops.
Yeah.
Because it is such a much better life without drops. So I offer it to everyone. Now, I differentiate the amount of surgery I'm doing depending on the severity. I may not do an eye stent or a hydrus for a severe glaucoma, but I would do a GAD or an eye track or an Omni for them.
So let's say you have the same patient you talked about. You do the cataract, plus you do your MIGS procedure, maybe GAD or Omni. And if that didn't work, then down the line, if it wasn't sufficient, a year, 2 years, 5 years later, then you could move to a tube or trab if needed.
Correct, because I'm not affecting the conjunctiva. So that's the ultimate real estate. That's like living in Fisher Island. You know, that's the most expensive zip code. We beat California. I mean, you're
number one in the country. Yeah.
I know, we beat you. I'm in Florida, so I can now brag that we have a more expensive zip code than you. But if you... That's conjunctiva is your Fisher Island. That's
real estate.
The real estate that you really, because once you use it, it's burnt. And there's only so much of it. So I try to keep those as a second stage. And I tell my patients, I can do small, medium, or large. Now, if you're only going to give me one shot at your glaucoma, I'm going to do large. But large has more risk. No pain, no gain. No more risk, higher success.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, but if my patient, I mean, and it happened to me, I had surgery and they offered small, medium, large. I offered medium and it ended up okay, not perfect, but my ankle is okay now. So I offer my patient small, medium, and large, and they get a choice. As long as they agree that in the future, because glaucoma is a marathon, not a sprint, cataract is a sprint. I fix you, I get you the best lens that we have available. We got you. That's 100 meters. Hussein Bolt, cataract coach.
There you go.
See? He used to do this. He would go to the, you remember Hussein Bolt? He would be that runner that was really fast. And at the end, he would take a few seconds to look at the camera and go. So that sprint for cataract surgery is not what we have for glaucoma.
You have a long marathon, many years marathon.
Right. So I tell them, you know, I may do small today, and in a couple of years we go to medium, and you may still need large surgery.
Right.
And I think that if we do the large surgery at a correct timing, so if you wait for that 0.99 nerve end stage field, I mean, there's a lot of risk. But if you take a patient with healthier conjunctiva that has been off of drops, and you do a good subconjunctival, whether it's a sen or a trap or a tube, you know, depending on what your decision is. If you have healthier conjunctiva and a healthier patient, you can get better outcomes.
Right. No, of course. So is it safe to say then you almost never will do a combined phaco trab?
Never.
So that's that's the old way of thinking then from 20 years ago.
No, I think that if I am going to do a phaco, I have smaller, efficient, safer things to do. And I can pick that eye without any cytokines, because you are doing surgery. You activate cytokines with any kind of intraocular surgery. So once you activate those cytokines, they are going out in the aqueous, right into that subconjunctival space. And that's what, you know, when you do a small, microinvasive subconjunctival surgery, you're not really messing up that much with the anterior chamber. And I think that quieter aqueous makes for a better bleb.
Wow. So yeah, so you're never really doing phaco trabs?
No. I mean, I'll do a phaco sen, and not even. I still wait for the sen. It's such a...
So do phaco wig, and then later down the road, if you need to, do something more invasive.
Correct. I would always set them up for the next one, but I don't know. In my hands, MIGs do really good. And if I can get 3 years off a trap, I'll take them.
Right.
I'm a little biased, you know, as I'm a glaucoma specialist, so I did cornea anterior segment. So what the referrals that come to you, they're the bad, the ugly. So you get a little more respectful.
And I still do,
So I still do a couple of traps, even a week I do a couple of traps, but I try to save that for when I have the best shot possible.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I never even thought about it that way, that the cytokines from the intraocular surgery can make the bleb fail prematurely. It makes sense now that you say it.
Yeah, you know, it's not a safety thing, because, I mean, you do a small sclerostomy, you put good sutures, but you want that flow to start immediately.
Right.
And if the cytokines are coming out, you're going to end up just getting Tenon's angry. Tenon's has a very short fuse, you know? He's kind of my Florida road rage.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. So some of my experiences, when I stopped teaching residents, but I did it for 22 years. I stopped 2 years ago. But we would have a lot.
You're still teaching us.
No, I teach the world now.
You're still teaching all of us.
But we would have a lot at our county hospital, which is like a charity type hospital. We'd have a lot of new presentation of neovascular glaucoma. And so we would see, because from bad diabetics or CRVO, that happened a few months ago.
Late.
So what's your proto approach to these? Because what we did was very aggressive. What we would end up doing is, of course, the patient's in your clinic. They're getting an anti-VEGF. We take them to the OR. If the patient's, let's say, 65 or older, we're going to take out the lens. while they're AFAQing on the OR table, going to put the indirect laser on, do PRP. Then we're going to put the IOL in. Then we're going to put the almond valve in. We're going to do everything at once.
Well, but here's the kicker. So you had one shot.
We had one shot.
In that population, if for somebody to go blind and lose their sight from neovascular glaucoma or 90-day glaucoma from a CRVO and not show up in time, you get one chance. So as I told you, if I'm going to only get one chance, I'm going to give you the big one.
Do everything.
Exactly, because that's your one chance to try to save it. Now, if you have a diabetic that slowly is coming, what I try to do is micropulse. Mm. So I get the anti-VEGF. The micropulse doesn't work long-term, but it will buy you a good month. So again, you have that angry eye full of blood vessels. The patient is in a lot of pain, inflamed AC, PAS, blood vessels in the iris. So you get that anti-VEGF and you do a micropulse that is a closed procedure. Mm-hmm. 3-4 weeks later, when that patient already had regression of the blood vessels, they get their second Avastin, and that's when you do the combo. So that patient already, you have this quiet eye, the eye that has no pain, the pressure has gone down. They get a couple of anti-VEGF injections that kind of lower that hot head. Right. And then you can then move on to doing the big one. So that's, at least in my hands, my protocol. I don't even see the patient when they call me, hey, I have a patient with a pressure of 60, neovascular. I'm like, I don't see that patient. That patient first gets a VEGF and gets into the retina clinic, not because I cannot put a VEGF.
Sure, sure, sure.
It's mainly because I want retina to be on board, because they are the ones that are going to really control that patient for the future.
Right.
And then I see them after the injection, schedule a micropulse, get them quiet down, and then plan for the phaco tube. And I would do a phaco tube much faster than I would do a phaco trap.
Got it. And which tube are you preferring these days? What's your kind of go-to?
I am an AMED lady. I think anytime I have to play with the muscles, my attention span is that of a hummingbird. So I learned years and years ago, I read this article, and then I actually gave the credit to somebody else. And Malik was like, no, actually, that was me, the one that published it, about gluing your tubes. Mm. So, and at some point, I basically put, I'm a chicken too. So I put one or two sutures to the plate, and then everything else gets glued in.
Huh.
Plunge, the patch. When I don't use a patch and I just do a tunnel, I still glue everything down, and it shaves down a lot of time in your surgery. Yeah. So when your surgical center gives you a little pushback because of the cost of the glue, you tell them you're going to book them two more cataracts in that time. Yeah, and they're happy. So I started gluing everyone.
Interesting.
And it saves so much time. I'll send you a video one day. So basically, you take the plate in. I do try to inject my Kenalog behind the plate, so I put it all the way back, and I do put a little Mito. I know that that's still controversial. I would give Mito to the plate at the end of the case, and I just tunnel my tube and put some tissue glue and hold that in place. Tomorrow I'm going to get adhesins, but so far everything has been good.
So but
I had a small dehiscence in my radial cord that I sutured in the slit lamp the next day, and that was it. So
you have to send us a video. We need a video.
Those are great. I mean, maybe I can be your little glaucoma coach.com.
We need it. We have quite a number of good glaucoma videos on Cataract Coach, because as you know, there's so much intersection between the two. But I'd love to feature your video. You send me the video. We'll have this podcast on a Sunday, and the very next day, the next Monday, we'll have your video. Oh, I'm here to learn.
Well, another learning point is that I think that the most difficult cataracts are the glaucoma patients.
Oh,
I mean,
for sure.
By definition, we have the worst cataracts, because people also delay them. No, who wants to take a cataract with a lot of pseudo eggs? So that gets putzed around a little. And by the time they come to you, they have a black cataract with pseudo X and a pressure of 40 with a lens.
And a shallow AC.
And a shallow AC is like a perfect combo for a catastrophe. So as a glaucoma surgeon, you also have to be a good cataract surgeon. And we take those pupils and we mess them up too, you know. Once you put a couple of PIs in that, you put a couple of traps, that iris is not as nice and taut as when you have a nice round
Absolutely. Wow. So I'm learning so much from you. Just I love the way you think about this, the way you approach it. I love your stepwise approach. And then also, most importantly, is like you said, tailoring it to your population. If you know this patient is going to come see you once, up day one, and you'll never see them again. You better do everything at once.
Everything. I mean, I had a patient that, swear to God, and I still know his last name because his last name was there's not that many last names. I did a trap on this gentleman, and he showed up. A year later, he got lost to follow-up, still with the stitches in the eye.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, I switched to nylon for my traps because patients feel it less than that Bicryl, and I hate seeing the Bicryl there. So I use nylon, and I remove it. So he came in, and he still had and the trap was functioning. He never used medicines. He never did anything. I mean,
but he had a great surgeon.
I think that was more luck than skill. But to this day, Mr. bless his heart, he luckiest man alive, I have to say. Year with stitches post trap, never came back. Never used a steroid. Never used an antibiotic.
Sometimes
you get lucky. But cataract is to me one of the biggest changes you can deliver a patient. Before, when you get the big cataracts, now it's a matter of quality. I think that as we have gotten younger, 40 is the new 40 is the new 60s, or 60 is the new 40s. So as we, my dad is about to turn 80. He still does surgery. He's still he decided to fall in love with keratoconus at 70.
Wow.
And he loves it. He does. He goes to meetings. He travels all over just to learn new techniques because he's still passionate. And in ophthalmology, we still can provide surgery as long as we have steady hands. But when I see him do surgery and still get the joy of it, if he's had cataracts and he could not function,
right? Of course,
you know, he's independent of glasses because he got surgery and is able to not have to wear them. His quality of life is so much better.
Yeah, it's an amazing surgery. I think that's one of the things that draws us all to ophthalmology is that the miracle of the white cataract, then the next morning, pow, normal vision.
I mean, yes, it's like they come out and they are like, I see you. Yeah. And I ask them the same question. Am I looking pretty or not? If not, you're still not ready. You still have other issues. You know, it all, the rules depend on how pretty I look. Some nights they better lie.
So you're saying your father's an ophthalmologist. So tell me, what was your path in ophthalmology? How did you get interested? You must have been a young child.
When I was a kid, my dad would bring all the surgical gowns and we would cut them and play doctor. It was always fun, you know. That was the go-to costume that we would get. And then early on, he got us to see. They used to do a lot of charity surgeries, so we used to go and help out.
Sure.
And then I was able to start it, you know, in med school. I would go with him and see him do surgery. And then I told him I wanted to do ENT.
Uh-oh.
And he almost disowned me. So I was like, Dad, I think I like ENT. I want to do neck surgery. Mm-hmm. And I was planning on, I'm originally from Panama. And in Panama, you still practice a lot of general ophthalmology, a lot of comprehensive ophthalmology, and a lot of comprehensive ENT. And he sat me down and said, Annalisa, what pays the bills for ophthalmology? And I was like, cataracts. And he said, no. He said, dry eye. Because patients come because they have dry eye, and then you find all the other stuff. That's the main complaint. I mean, they come in either blurry vision or dry eye. And he looked at me and said, you know what pays the bills for ENT? Earache. Full of kids coming to your clinic, crying in pain with earache. And I switched my registration and switched to ophthalmology right after that. But I was very blessed to be able, and my first cataract, my first phaco was with him.
Oh, wow.
That was quite magical. I got to do transplants with him. I've been going to Panama to do charity. Mm-hmm. In Panama, they have a bad situation trying to get tissue. So I get donations from different eye banks, and I walk around with my little bag of corneas, and I take them from Miami to Panama. And wow, we're able to do it for the patients that don't have the means to buy a cornea. And I got to do some of those with him last year, and that was... Wow.
Fantastic.
That was amazing. That was a beautiful moment, which most likely you're gonna get to have in a couple of years with your son.
Son, daughter, we'll see. Time will tell.
Amazing guy.
Time will tell. So then you finish your medical school and then work with your dad a little bit. Then you came to Tulane. So you said I'm gonna switch gears completely.
Well, no. I finished as a med student. I actually got to rotate in Tulane for my fourth year. So I did a whole year at Tulane, and when I fell in love with ENT. And then I switched back and I ended up going back to Tulane, and my kind of town, you know, you cannot complain. You have a little bit of Bourbon Street, a little bit of sitting in the porch and talking, and a great, great way of life. So I fell in place. I fell right in a good spot.
And then, of course, Charity Hospital, busy. You learn by doing. You work hard.
Oh, yes. And you couldn't be putzy. So another big tip for learning surgeons is if you get too used to having too many gadgets. So if you have 10,000 different hooks that you use, in every case, and if you have a lot of things, the day you don't have them, you don't know how to maneuver. Right. At Charity Hospital, we got one chopper. And you were lucky that you had a 0.12 and a needle driver. So you got to be efficient with your surgery. Mm-hmm. And that going in and out of the eye as you're doing cataract, I think increases your chances of ending up in a wrong spot. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how many instruments you use. By now, you are so
very few. Very few. In my own cases, I have a speculum, a fixation ring, a chopper,
and then my cannula,
and then the diamond blades.
Yes, that's it. That's the same I use. I mean, it. And once you get used to that, your surgery becomes efficient. So I think that. It's super important for younger people to get used to using the same instrument, not be trying a lot of new things at the beginning. Get comfortable with the standard. By now, I can take a cataract out, same as you, with anything.
But once
you're comfortable with what you have, it's so much easier. It's so much easier to get around. So I finished at Charity and at Tulane doing my residency, and I walked up to Ramesh and I said, hey, I want to stay here and do a fellowship here. So Dr. Delmar Caldwell, back in the day, he was quite big in cornea. He was starting to putz around with doing DSIC. DSIC was not out. Mm. So imagine, I mean, I'm kind of dating myself, but I remember he would actually do a LASIK flap and then have this floating lamellar cornea that he would put the LASIK flap and suture it, if it was a PKP. I mean, it was big surgery. But I got to learn from cornea and glaucoma and do lots and lots of surgery. It's so important. The more you do, the better.
Right. And there is something to be said for being simplistic in your instrument choices, right? A great surgeon can operate with any chopper. It doesn't matter. In fact, when I would teach residents, for a beginning resident, I'd say, okay, you don't know how to divide the nucleus. Let me just do this. I would just use a 27-gauge cannula and a BSS syringe in one hand, chopper in the other, impale the nucleus and chop it into pieces just with those two and say, okay, now put the probe in and check it out.
Is that what it, so they would come in and so we also learn like that. So
yeah.
What is the most important part of a cataract surgery? What is the crucial spot for you? I know which one I think it is, but so to me is the wound. If you have a messy wound, you know, everything leaks, the iris pops out, you don't get a chamber formed, your whole surgery becomes difficult.
The posterior capsule starts floating around.
Everything. You don't have good fluidics. So your case just becomes a nightmare just because you did that bad wound. So I remember the resident that my third year would do the wound and tell me, like, chop it. Like you said, now eat it. And you would go in with a fake one. You were so afraid. But really having that initial step, that wound good, is what's – and for mix is also super important.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have a self-sealing wound, that viscoelastic that keeps your chamber deep is going to burp out. And then you're going to have to be refilling. And so the wound to me is that crucial step, which with Femto, it makes it easier. But I think that learning how to do a good wound should be number one for a resident.
Oh, for sure. And I think the incisions made with a diamond keratome for sure, but maybe even a steel keratome are better than a femto incision for a main incision.
I can do, like you said, by now, we can do it with anything.
Right.
I don't judge. You want to do a femto, if in your hands is safer,
go for it. Yeah, for sure.
I didn't use a femto in my previous practice. And to me, having a self-sealing wound was so important.
For sure.
For sure. I think that to me it's so, so, so key. And learning how to do it, because even if you try a laser, the laser is not working. What are you going to do?
Right. Of course. I always say your signature on every eye for cataract surgery, the surgeon's signature is the incision and the rexus. Because even 10 years later, some other ophthalmologist will look at that eye and say, let me see the incision. Let me see the rexus.
It's true. And sometimes if you put it too anterior, you get this thick, thick, thick white channel that, looks so ugly. And now that the incisions are temporal, you cannot hide them. They're in plain sight.
They're in plain sight for every future ophthalmologist to look at the eye and see.
And then you get somebody with light color eyes and you mess up that iris. The patient is a Flomax. And then you end up with, like, everybody can tell. So it's so important to have that good wound to get that fluidics right in the angle, in the eye, you know?
Well, that's one of the tough things we do that sometimes people don't appreciate is, you know, you had an ankle surgery. Well, if it's not quite perfect, you'll never know.
Exactly.
But with the eyes and the vision, your cataract surgery is not quite there. Patient sees every day through with your surgery.
Oh, yes. No, and their family members see it. It's like, what is that thing? So, I mean, and I think you were talking about it in your last session, which, by the way, was amazing.
We had a 1 hour best of cataract coach session at the
And I have to say that was when they asked me what was the best, I thought that was because it's like when Osher talks, is where you really learn a lot of stuff. I'm telling you, you know, when I give a lecture on something, seeing the practice is so important and seeing the difficult part, you know, because you're not shy of showing like the Argentinian flag in a white cataract. So those are where you learn. And you were talking about the fourth row technique.
Fourth row pupilloplasty, yes, for other ones.
That was the second thing I've learned in all the years I've been out that really changed the way I practice.
Yeah, it makes it easy.
It is so easy. And you can, I mean, if you have a little pupil defect, just fix it right away. It won't take you that much longer.
Right.
I mean, it's just so easy. So that's one thing. Learn that one, everybody. It's an important one.
No, it is. It is for sure. Yeah, there's so many great techniques here. In fact, that's why I started Cataract Coach. I wanted to have all this information in one spot. And then I want to give away all the pearls, all the tricks, all the secrets. Just have it. Let it be out there for everyone.
But we have to. If we don't help each other, you know that there's, 3.5 million cataracts performed every year.
So now it's four. U.S. 4 million.
4 million already. So, and we're 32,000 ophthalmologists.
And not all do cataract surgery.
Exactly. And most of them do 300-400 cataract surgeries a year. So the burden of this surgery is really ending up on surgeons that are 1,000 plus. Right. Some of us that are 2,000 plus, you know, are really holding this burden that we need to give it out to everybody. The one that is doing 200 needs to get efficient and safe enough so he can take it up, because the population needs it.
No, for sure. I think there's a shortage of ophthalmologists now. We need to have a lot more being produced. Or, like I said, each surgeon needs to step up the volume even more, for sure.
And to step up the volume, you need to be secure in it. If you're doing a 25, 30-minute cataract, you're not going to do more, you know? So one of the things that you learn as you become is efficiency.
Yeah, so, for sure. Efficiency comes. And then we never seek out speed, because speed comes automatically.
Exactly. With speed is not the answer. But yeah, if you're taking a long time, most likely you're not being efficient.
Yeah, you're wasting movements.
Exactly. So that to me it's another pearl, you know? Sometimes... And you're the coach. I was telling a surgeon that we tend to be quite cocky, you know. We became doctors, so we're top. And then we became ophthalmologists, so we're even more top. And then we're great surgeons, so we're like, you know, Magic Johnson. Michael Jordan.
Yeah, for sure.
Michael Jordan. Or Tiger Woods. And they still have a coach.
Yeah, you always do.
And the coach is not as good as they are.
Correct.
And not even get close to as good as they are.
Right.
But they can change things and make them better.
Yes, for
so
sure.
So as good and as bad, you know, I'm not allowed to say that, no? As bad as we are,
yeah,
as surgeons, we still should get a coach to guide us. Because sometimes... is little things that make you efficient. It's little things that you can tweak, little pearls that you can adapt.
Right.
That will change the way your outcomes and your speed in surgery and your efficiency in surgery and your safety in surgery is. Because you can try to go as fast as you can, and if you drop a nucleus back and forth,
now
that
what?
Actually is a no-go. So
right.
Being fast is not the goal. It's safe and efficiency.
Yeah, the tough part too is that, you know, if you're a basketball player, like you're Michael Jordan, if you can shoot 90% from the free throw line, wow, he's incredible. But you can't shoot 90% success in the OR. Even 99% success in the OR is questionable. You better be dang close to 100% success. That's the tough part.
I was actually sharing the podium with a younger ophthalmologist.
Okay.
And he was bragging that he has never seen a hyphema after mix.
Uh-oh.
And I just looked at him and I said, because I know his numbers.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, if you don't do the dishes, you won't break the dishes. If you're doing a few cases, you won't see
right
all the complications that can arise.
Sure.
Because they are there. A hyphema after a mix is there. You do a GAD, you expect a hyphema.
Right.
You know, so, and it's how to handle it. So you can never brag. I've never dropped lens. I've never broken capsule. You know, I've never had a, because if you're saying it, you just haven't done enough. Because as good as you and me can be, every so often, we get a shower. You know,
right.
Every so often you get a challenge.
Yeah.
So it is important to still be humble. And to strive that if a complication does happen, know how to fix it.
Of course.
That wraps it up. Know how to put a stitch. Know how to fix that wound. Know how to correct. Know how to do a fourth row papilloplasty so that iris doesn't look bad.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those things that we learn to do as experienced surgeons are what makes our complications seem very inconsequential.
Right.
You know,
for sure. And that's how we learn too. We all learned that from Dr. Osher, where he shows his complications. So, and by cataract coach session, case number one is how somehow I broke a capsule during IA. And I replay the video, slow motion, and I still don't know why.
But again, if you were not doing surgery, this would never happen to you.
Right.
And if you're doing 100 cases or 200 cases, you may, but if you're doing 1,000, statistically,
you see more.
Ain't gonna happen.
Right.
As careful as you are, but if you have a broken capsule, you can fix it. That patient still can get an IOL, whether in the sulcus or with a reverse pupillary capture.
Yeah.
Or capsular capture. So you will be able to fix it because you have the experience. Somebody that has never seen it, they may end up on retina. We had another surgeon that he dropped nucleus and he sent the patient a phakic to the retina doctor. Who's better qualified to put a sulcus lens or to suture a lens? The retina guy or us that are working in the anterior segment? Right. So those are little things that you want to learn as you go on.
Right. No, of course. I mean, for a drop nucleus, I always say there are two types of ophthalmologists who don't drop a nucleus. Number one, those.
Happy birthday.
There you go. Those who lie about it and those who don't operate.
Exactly. That's exactly. If you don't do the dishes, you won't break the dishes.
Right. No, for sure. That makes a ton of sense, of course. And in those cases, well, yeah, I agree with you. Clean up what you can. In my case, when the capsule broke, I knew how to react instantly. So I kept the antihyaloid paste intact.
Don't pull out.
So yeah, I kept everything antihyaloid paste intact. I was able to put the sulcus lens in with the optic capture three-piece lens. And zero issue, no vitreous prolapse.
And the patient has great vision.
Yes. The patient never needs a YAG capsulotomy.
You saved him a surgery. See, even nicer. You fixed it. You did double surgery. You should charge him twice. Now, talking seriously, it's how you handle that complication. Because
of course.
Sadly, we cannot all be, but we have to strive to be close to 100. That's the goal. Right. We owe it to our patients, and we owe it to our patients to continue to learn. Mm-hmm. There's so many new things, you know. I started training back when there was no anti-VEGF, so you had
You and me both.
So you had that CNB, and you were blind. That was it. You know, you maybe got PDT, but you were blind. And then that was a huge revolution, and then in 2010s, we got the mixed revolution.
Right.
And now I don't have to wait for you to be end stage to do surgery on you in glaucoma.
Mm-hmm.
And now in the 20s and the, you know, 2015s, we got a huge improvement in refractive lens exchange and the quality of the IOLs.
Sure.
I think that we're still living in the last 20 years. Ophthalmology has changed. What we can deliver to our patients is so huge. I think we need to learn. We all learn it. I mean, you learn refractive lens on the job.
No, I mean, of course,
all the MIGs you learn on the job, you know, all of this, but we have to keep updating ourselves. We cannot just stay stagnant.
Of course. So what do you do for fun? Let's talk about something outside of ophthalmology.
Outside of ophthalmology. So I am a humongous scuba diver.
Oh, wow.
And there's a little chat in WhatsApp called I Dive that all of ophthalmologists that dive, every time there's a Caribbean eye or Hawaiian eye, we're always trying to plan a little sneak out to go scuba dive a little. It was to the point that it was a requirement for my husband. Actually, he's a huge scuba diver. My kids started diving at 10
when
they were 10 years old. So we're a scuba diving family. I think it's amazing what you can see underwater. You know, I see space. I'm never going to go, but I can see a whole new world underwater. So that's.
I better learn then. I'm not in this club. I don't know how to scuba.
Oh, well, you know, it's so easy. Everybody thinks it's like an extreme sport. It's basically snorkeling for lazy people because you get an oxygen tank and then you're like, okay, let me see the little fish here. And you keep breathing like you breathe now and you get to see the fish right here. Instead of seeing it from far away and really braving the waves and stuff in the in the surf, you know, you're underwater. And if the current is hard, you go deep and you get close to the sand. And it's just so beautiful. The colors you see are outstanding. I still, when I got my husband to dive, this is a funny story. I'm fixing all his gear because you have all this gear on when you're diving. Right. And he grabs me by the shoulders and turns me around. And there's a big shark coming right at us. And I looked at him after. He stayed quite calm. I have to give it to him. And I'm like, were you using me as a shield?
Shield.
Right in front of him. I'm like, were you using me as a shield? You know, all I need to do is cut you a little and sweep the other way and the shark will have you. And that was the joke. It's been an ongoing joke throughout all of our dives that he tried to use me as shark bait.
That's too funny. Oh, that sounds amazing.
And I like to travel a lot. We're big travelers. We are a family of mutts. So I was born in Houston, grew up in Panama. My soul is in New Orleans and I live in Miami. And I married a French guy from Bordeaux. And we have American kids that consider themselves fully American. So we get to travel a lot because we have to visit family and get to see quite a few experiences. We just were hiking in the jungle.
Where?
We did. So I used to do this a lot and my husband loved it again too. So you hike up this in the middle of nowhere. You're truly in the jungle, like those reality shows, and you are in your jungle and you have to carry all your water because you don't want to get sick. Mm-hmm. And we hike all the way up to the top of the mountain and then you get to sleep there. And everybody says, are you using a camping tent? And I tell them, in the jungle, you never want to be in the floor. That's where all the creepy crawlers are. Mm-hmm. So you actually sleep in hammocks. So you hang your hammock and you put a tarp for the rain, because it is the rainforest. So there's some drizzle at night and you have a hammock with a zipper. So everybody's like, ooh, you're so romantic. I'm like, no. Everybody gets in their hammock. You zip yourself up and you don't get out of that zipper because the bugs can come and get you.
Which country was this?
Huh?
In which country was this?
So we were in Panama. We actually went, there's no civilization. Nobody lives up there. You couldn't see a house. Up in the distance, you could see the ocean. It was by a place called Cerro Trinidad, Trinity. Mm-hmm. Mountain, and it was just so beautiful. I mean, you get toucans and all kinds of, you only see animals. It's hard. You can get to see some monkeys, but you don't get to see a lot of jaguars and stuff unless you go to Darien in Panama.
Oh, that sounds so amazing.
Well, what do you do? I mean,
I make cataract coach videos.
Also, you live and breathe ophthalmology. That is
no. Wonderful. I actually, obviously, I have my interests. I mean, just now before calling you, I was lifting weights today. I've got my favorite bench press. Love that.
But I was going to try to bring up your watch.
Yeah,
that's where I was expecting. Well, you told me the other day that you actually built the watch. I thought that was so cool that you could actually build a watch. And then you were telling me how techie you are.
Well, it's so easy. The watch building is not really building a watch. It's kind of more assembling it.
Well, but that's still, I mean, that's microsurgery too.
Yeah, it's like, you can change the watch hands and face and the case and the dial. And so it's
all fun. Do you have the little glasses that have the magnification like they do?
I just do it under the surgical microscope. It's even better.
Oh my God, that is such a great idea. You take them to work.
The watchmakers use like a monocular, one eye. Yes. To the work. I like depth perception, so I just do it under the surgical microscope.
Do you tilt the head?
I don't tilt the head. I just keep it straight. But hey, I'm going to learn these pearls. You gave me some great pearls today, which I really like. So let me summarize for my younger viewers. Getting in the mix, start with something simple. Maybe KDB, maybe iStent, something similar to this design. Even before you go to the OR, in your clinic, put that gonio mirror up on everyone. Learn all the whole spectrum of what they can look like. In the OR, make sure you get the good incision so they're not going to cause too much bleeding. And make sure the incision doesn't leak. Tilt the head. I'm going to do this now. Tilt the head even more.
So you don't have to waste your time trying to find that microscope.
That's fantastic. And then finally, another one. Okay to use Tri-Pan Blue to stain?
If you see
the angle structures better?
And then what else? If you get a little bleed, this is key because as we talked, if you may end up in trouble. Yeah. If you have a bleeder, leave some air in the AC.
Oh, interesting.
You
put a viscoelastic there.
Then you risk it that they may have a little bit more of a pressure spike. And then if you fill it up with viscoelastic and you try to burp the wound, use only your paracentesis.
No, yeah, not the main.
You don't want to collapse that. That up and down pressure is really a problem. So my suggestion, put an air bubble and put a stitch. If you have bleeding, do those two.
And then finally, you have to give me a video. I need to learn how to do your tube with glue.
Glue the tube. Not my idea, but I will announce it to everyone. It saves so much time.
Yeah, I'd love to have it. I'd love to feature a video about that. Well, I had an amazing time talking to Annalisa. What an incredible amount of energy you have. Such a passion. I love it. Oh,
thank you. Just drawing from you.
Oh, you're too sweet. So let's get that video from you. I'll feature it tomorrow. I want to remind my viewers and listeners, remember, we have a new Cataract Coach podcast every week. It's on Amazon, Spotify, Google, Apple, and more, YouTube, and more. And also check out the website, cataractcoach.com. We have a free PDF book about everything learning cataract surgery. And we have a whole section of glaucoma and mixed procedures all on Cataract Coach, and soon to have Annalisa's glued-in tube.